Hands together at our hearts and bowing to all that is, with such gratitude for whatever we have, whoever we are, whatever we were seeking, whatever we have found. Bowing with unconditional gratitude. Om Shanti. Remembering when you go home and something lovely gives you pause and you say to yourself, Om Shanti. Remembering that you are a being of peace. And remembering also Krishna's promise to Arjuna, I am the sound in Om. It's so beautiful. You know, sometimes a single Om can take us to the other shore, can't it? Wow. I want to remind you of this beautiful teaching from Taiha Dushadan that Donna brought to us, bringing it to us from a retreat where she discovered it 10 years ago, where it says, above all, trust the slow work of God. We are quite naturally impatient to reach the end without delay. We should like to skip the intermediate stages. In other words, go straight to enlightenment. We are impatient of being on the way to something unknown and new. And yet, it is the law that progress is made by passing through some stage of instability. This is so true and so necessary. And I am sure that each one of you has experienced this on the retreat, that you have had moments of very uncomfortable instability, as well as moments of great joy, which I've seen all over your faces, and moments of truth about your sorrows. But there are also these moments when the earth, which is not earth, within us shifts and we don't know quite where the ground is that we are standing on. And these are very uncomfortable times in anybody's life, even if we've endured them many times over, as those of us who are accumulating decades will have done. Yeah, we've been there before, and yet it makes us just as uncomfortable, and sometimes more so because we think we ought not to be again in this place. But this is the necessary place that leads us to change. This is the necessary place that leads us to interrogate and investigate and wisely question some of our habits which may no longer serve us well or others. We are all in a constant state of evolution. How do we cooperate with that? Well, we cooperate with it in part by being stable in the face of our own instabilities, trusting that it is part of the process. And yes, we're awfully grateful when we meet a time of oasis or what is it on the mountain when you have a bit of a plateau, exactly, yes. We're so, and we sometimes think the plateau ought to last forever. But in my experience, it does not. And why should it? And why would it? Because there's something else always to be discovered. So this becomes not only bearable and tolerable, it becomes exciting and radiant, even if scary, when we know that we are not doing this alone, that we have the stout stick, not the stout stick of certainty, but the stout stick of trust. which is different. We can afford to trust that inspiration will come to us, that consolation will come to us, that forgiveness will come to us, that insight and wisdom will come to us. If we make ourselves available to receive it. And I have to say, you have been a group of marvelous receivers. I know that some of you are on retreat for the very first time, and you accepted the intensity of it, the strangeness of it, and perhaps also the deep familiarity of it. Because there is something about coming home to a retreat that is familiar to many people, even if you haven't been on retreat before. Because it's like a cradle where you can afford to be your more vulnerable self. Because you are actually experiencing, not just hoping for, but experiencing that you are experiencing this, whatever this is in your thisness, you are experiencing this in a tremendously safe place, in a sanctuary of love. So your next challenge is to take home, your awareness and your trust and your willingness to experiment that wherever you are in the presence of love. And you will forget. And the forgetting does not matter. What matters, what strengthens you, what nourishes the very ground of your being is the remembering. Please give yourselves as many opportunities as you can to remember who you are, to remember what you are, to be with yourself in a loving and supportive and wise and strengthening way. Something that just goes significantly beyond psychological self-support. I was very struck to realize through my daughter's studies that in the what's called the Canadian model of occupational therapy, the very center of it, and they teach this diagrammatically as well as theoretically, the very center of it is called the patient's, maybe they call it the client's, spiritual needs. And they don't define spiritual in any way as religious, but they define it in a way, although they don't mention Viktor Frankl, in a way that's very reminiscent of logotherapy, which is that above everything, and truly above everything, even almost above food, well, we have to have food to survive, but and water even more, but above everything, we need a sense of meaning. And that's how spiritual is. We need to find meaning. Not reasons why. That's sometimes very superficial. But we need to feel that our life has meaning. And this has to come from within, and it has to be experienced through the ways that we behave beyond ourselves. It has to be rooted in a valuing of life itself. Belief systems, not belief systems. It's all secondary. Secondary. Primary is this conviction that life itself matters, and that my dignity, my mana, my M-A-N-A, mana, my spiritual well-being and power depends on my sense of integrity and recovering from when we slip. It doesn't have to be, I now have integrity. No, that would be an armoring. But a willingness also to return to a place not only of integrity, but of integration. Of integration of what we learn little bit by little bit through our sorrows as well as through our joys. What we learn little bit by allowing ourselves to look deeply into the face of another person. What we allow ourselves to learn through sitting in silence with a loved one. What we allow ourselves to learn from the coming into life of the new births and the leaving of this body, as people do in death. What we allow ourselves to be conscious of, and what we allow ourselves also to know through those moments of deep contemplation, when what we think of as our individual mind, what we possess in our thoughts as our individual mind, when we actually allow that through the process that we call meditation to settle into greater mind, which is, of course, our constant home. For those of you who have a little problem with the word God, just be patient with me when I just quote this incredible verse from Wordsworth, who was a man of his time, as we are all women and men of our times. When he said, "Not in entire forgetfulness, and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home." We don't entirely forget, and we are not entirely naked. We are still, at least when we allow it, trailing clouds of glory. And when we have a moment of resting upon, receiving, dancing to the rhythms of singing, rejoicing, weeping too, in the presence of the ineffability of that. The ineffability means it's beyond all words. It's beyond our understanding. And yet somehow we can experience it. And we don't experience it only with the conscious mind. In fact, sometimes the conscious mind is an obstruction. So I just want to finish by saying that I learnt something profound about this from all my years of working on the poetry of Rainer Maria Rilke, which could have seemed like a strange luxury, particularly in the life of a writer who has to make a living from that, and knowing that this would never be anything but a very tiny minority interest. And I often asked myself, how could you be doing this? But there were some things that I learnt from that troubled man who wrote magnificent poetry. And one of the reasons he interested me was that he was a troubled man. He wasn't an enlightened being who just, you know, had a great flow. He was, like most of us, complex. And not in all parts of his life did he behave well. Nevertheless, he allowed himself to know some things, and he allowed himself to share them with quite magnificent sensitivity. And one of the things, I know a number of you have a very strong feeling for creatures that are not human. And one of the things that he allowed himself to know was the naturalness with which animals perceive what Rilke called the open. Now, we know that animals are also not uniformly tuned, that even within a species there is great variation on how tuned an animal is, just as there is great variation within our own species as to how tuned we are. Nevertheless, Rilke gave animals the credit of knowing that the unlimited and the infinite is actually an experience. It's not an abstraction, it's an experience. And that when animals, and sometimes children, open their eyes and look into the open, they know that what they are experiencing is the infinity of the infinite, the allness of the all. And I think this becomes particularly meaningful, and I don't know in which way it will be meaningful for you, but I believe it is meaningful if I also tell you that Rilke came to the end of his life in his early 50s, and he was absolutely inconsolable that he was dying. He felt he still had much to do, many poems to write and life to be lived. And he had had a long, long, very fractured connection with a woman who was older than him, much more of an intellectual than he was, a psychoanalyst called Lou Andrea Salome. And he held on to the illusion that if only Lou could tell him what was wrong with him psychologically, he would get better. But in fact, his body was overwhelmed by an illness that he could not recover from. So he had all that struggle, which we would recognize, all that longing to postpone death, even though he'd written a lot about it, a lot. And then, when it came to the moment of his dying, it was reported by the people who witnessed it, and who were not like disciples, they were medical people, matter of fact, that he opened his eyes to the open and died. We are living in that open. Living, not just dying. We are living in that openness. Yeah. We are living in a place of belonging. We are living in a place of soul and spirit and Buddha nature. And as we come awake and as we open our eyes to the open, we are coming awake to what this gift of life actually means in our particularity, in our particular essence and expression of it. And this is the foundation of your self-love. Every one of you. Every one of you. And I include myself. Every one of us. Every one of us is called to grow in self-love, in self-appreciation, in self-encouragement, in feelings of sufficiency, in order that we can be more freely present to the presence of others, in order that we can be more freely self-forgetting. It's when we're most anxious that we have to kind of cling to ourselves, and we're worrying so desperately what you might think of me, or what I might be thinking of you, or something. It's when we are most trusting that we can be most present to the other, and less jolted and less irritated by what's actually petty, when probably what we really need is a cup of tea and a lie down. Not a metaphysical insight, but a bit of physical rest. Don't disregard physical rest. Really, don't disregard physical rest. We're in the body. And it is from the body also that we greet one another. And so before we hear from one another in the way of greeting and goodbye, I'm just going to leave you with some beautiful words from Mahatma Gandhi. No surprise to you that he's a beloved teacher of mine. I offer you peace. I offer you love. I offer you friendship. I see your face. I feel your feelings. Beautiful music. Beautiful music. All fine. All fine.
It's a call to dance.
Call to dance. Back to Gandhi. Back to Gandhi. My wisdom comes from the highest source. I bow to that wisdom in you. Let us work together for unity and love. Om Shanti.